This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
We are once again continuing what has become a very popular series here on Financial Sense. Over the last couple of months, part of our Lifetime Income series, we have been discussing the issue of retirement planning. And we have done studies that have dealt with couples who were older. Either A, they were retired, or B, they're not quite at retirement age, but all of a sudden, presto change-o, they have to retire. They get a forced option, like we're having a bunch of layoffs, but we'll give you this early retirement option. What do you do? Now, we're going to do a flip on this now and do it from a young person's perspective. Here you are, wet behind the ears, fresh out of college, don't know squat about life. I won't go down that road.
You may get in trouble with your own children there, buddy.
I'm perpetually in trouble with my own kids. That's all right. It's a way of life here. Anyway, if you're starting out, you really need to have a plan. And if you start with a plan, this is going to make a big difference as to where you wind up 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, bearing in mind that quite often life throws you curves. You can vary your plan. You can make revisions in it based on real-world considerations, but you should at least have a plan. So we're calling this series Young and Wanting to Retire Rich. I just want to know who Rich is and why you want to get rid of him, Jim, because you're going to retire. Okay. Anyway, go ahead. Pick it up.
All right. Every study that I've ever read on retirement planning and success, John, I think it could be boiled down to two simple elements. One, begin early. And number two, invest on a regular basis. And this boils down to these elements. Save, have a plan, and diversify. I mean, it doesn't get more simpler than this, because obviously, if, let's say, I don't know, you're 21, 22, out of college, maybe 24, 25, if you went on to graduate school, you start out in life. If you can start saving at age 25, I'll give you some examples of the major difference here. You certainly stand a better chance because at age 25, you've got 40 years ahead of you of saving and investing towards your retirement goals. And obviously, if you can compound money, and the real key to accumulating wealth is compounding, if you can do it at an earlier age, you're going to be much better off. First of all, it takes less money. And number two, you've got time working in your favor versus waking up at age 50 and say, oh my, I'm 10 years away from retirement. I better get doing something. Obviously, the shorter amount of time that you have between where you are now in retirement, the less likely, unless you win the lottery or, you know, you pick the next Google or Apple, the less likely you are to achieve success in reaching retirement.
Well, let's take a real world example right now. My youngest is in graduate school. It's going to be another probably 3 years before he gets a PhD. He'll graduate then. He'll be about 27 when he comes out. Now, if he starts savings then versus, say, when he gets to be 40, what kind of a difference will this make? Because the idea that savings and investment compounds, and the earlier you start, the better, this is important.
Well, okay, so we're going to take two examples. Troy, and I'll just say 25 or 27 versus, let's say, Troy at age 42. And let's just say that when Troy gets out, he gets his PhD, and he can put away $4,000 a year. Maybe he does this with the 401k program. And let's assume over a long period of time that he would earn a rate of return that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 5.5% to 7%. Now, if he starts out at age 25 versus, let's say, age 40, let's say 15 years later, assuming that he invested, John, for 10 years, that from age 27 to age 37, he was putting away money, but at age 37, he's got a family now, he's got a couple kids, he's saving for college, and he stops saving. Versus, let's say, he does all this stuff, saving for, let's say, his kids' education, he gets married, plans for college education, a down payment, and a house, and he postpones saving for retirement till, let's say, age 47, or 42, that is. Let's talk about the difference between those two numbers. Now, assuming he put away $44,000 a year over a 10-year period, so he would invest $40,000 out of his income, and then at, let's say, at age 37, he stops. That money would grow at age 65 to $450,000. Now, let's take the case where Troy delays putting money aside and waits till, let's say, he's age 42, 15 years difference. If he put aside $4,000 a year for the rest of his working career, he would actually put aside $100,000, and that money would only grow to $270,000. The big difference, John, is by starting earlier, that money's going to compound over a 40-year period of time versus that money compounding over a 25-year period of time. It makes a whopping big difference in terms of the outcome.
But in all honesty, Jim, there are problems that young people face when they come out of college that I don't think were really as pertinent to us. The levels of, say, for example, college debt that you have when I came out of college was very, very manageable and got paid off both for myself and for Carol when we came out of our various programs. We were able to pay that off within a certain amount of time, and it was done and over with. You hear these horror stories about people coming out of college now and being $100,000, $150,000 in debt, saddled with it, and already trying to do what you're saying, saving, but they're swimming uphill against this mountain of debt. So they're doing that. Number two, they're chasing inflation upwards. So the whole economic situation right now, not only just being able to get a job, but even if they get a job, even a good paying job, they're chasing this inflation ratchet all the way up the hill as well. It's like trying to, you know, the myth of Sisyphus, just carrying a huge sack up to the top of the hill, etc. And then there's the standard thing of delayed gratification, whereby, you know, I'm in the minute, I just want to get my car, want to get married, want to get the wife, want to, you know, whatever it happens to be. And then the one, of course, my son's going to have to deal with, which is what I call the John retirement plan, which is he's going to have to take care of his old man when I need it. No, but in all seriousness, you know what I'm saying. And by the way, we may be joking about that, Jim, but I don't know if you've read the stories lately where a lot of people now, baby boomers and then Gen Xers, are having to care for their elderly parents. And you and I both know that Medicare isn't going to cover all this. When it finally blows out, it's not going to be there, and family's going to have to be taking care of family again.
You know, John, the issue of inflation was an issue. I would say the inflation rates, at least when I started out of college in the 70s, were much higher than where they were today. I think in, what was it, 1979, the inflation rate was, official inflation rate, remember, this was before they were cooking the books, was over 14.5%. So, John, the issue of inflation and all the other things, it all gets down to a very simple rule, which is pay yourself first. And that is strive to save 10% of your income. And the easiest way to do that is you start your first job, is enroll in the company's 401k program. So the money is automatically taken out of your paycheck. You never get to see it. And in many of these plans, John, at work, there's matching contributions by the employer. A lot of companies will match 50% of the contributions up to a certain level. So imagine if you put 10% of your pay into 401k program, or 6%, and the company matches it by 50%, you've gotten a 50% return in the first year that you put your savings aside. And that is going to discipline you to live within your means. And one of the biggest problems that young people face is weighing carefully and understanding the benefits of savings, and in particular, savings versus adding debt, and especially credit card debt. which can easily be probably one of the most destructive forces in the ways of achieving retirement readiness, especially given the high interest rates commonly associated with this form of credit. I mean, I've seen interest rates from 11.9 to, or let's say, call it rounded off 12 to 14% to 20% if you get delayed in behind. And let me give you an example of how important this is. Assume that you have the opportunity of to either put money aside or to go out and spend it and put it on a credit card. If you were to take a credit card balance of $5,000 over a 30-year period, and many people go throughout their adult life with credit card balances, assuming a 13.4% interest rate, which is the average on credit card debt, that individual on that $5,000 credit card balance would pay $20,130 in interest over a 30-year period on that $5,000 balance. Instead of that, let's say that money was invested. Consider that $20,130 paid out in finance interest, if it was invested instead, would grow to $52,570. And so one of the many things that a lot of financial planners will counsel individuals. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, some credit card company.
Well, they say, there's nothing wrong with your credit card, but we'd like to talk to you.
Speaking of the topic, that's amazing, John. Here we are doing the show talking about credit, and I just got a non-solicited phone call from a credit card company. Oh, talk about perfect timing. But anyway, I wanted to get back to the point that, you know, a lot of financial planners will try to counsel individuals about eliminating non-deductible high interest debt. And that's the thing that happened with the Reagan tax reform. They eliminated a lot of credit card interest. And so anytime you have high credit card balances, high priority, your first priority should be to pay off those credit cards, because it's very doubtful in this kind of environment if you're going to find 14% annual returns in this kind of market. I mean, even though the market's up 14% this year, this is not going to happen every year, I can assure you. So getting rid of debt and trying to keep it manageable is probably the most smartest and intelligent thing that you can do in beginning out your adult life planning for retirement.
Well, like I said before, though, I mean, how do you balance what are really competing goals? Because when you're young, you want to get married, and typically they want to own a home. Not a bad time to do it right now, as a matter of fact, depending on where you are. Want to have a nice car. And then there's college for the kids. Takes a while to get to the college for the kids, but you have to plan for it. And retirement, invariably, if you watch, as you go through this stack of priorities, goes blah, 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 right down to the bottom of the list, because as you and I well know, retirement is a long way, way on the distant horizon. And then all of a sudden, it's there.
If you take a look at that, I mean, obviously, you know, saving money for a down payment on a home, saving money if you have children for their college education. And then, of course, you know, down the road, I mean, if obviously at age 25 or even 35, retirement is still 30 years away. So it's a long way off. You can't accomplish all these goals at once. And what I think is very important is you got to prioritize them. All right. Obviously, if you're starting out, probably at the top of the list is going to be saving for a down payment on a home. If you're starting out as a family, putting some money aside for your kids' education. And then also, don't forget, something that's very important is emergency funds, because we are seeing in this kind of economy downsizing and restructuring. I mean, the case of Carl and Tisch last week, where he was faced with the early retirement package that basically if he didn't take it, he probably wasn't going to have a job. And we're seeing that more and more, and especially in this kind of economy where unemployment or underemployment remains persistently high. So it's not just that you're trying to save for a house, down payment, money putting aside for a college education, but also to have emergency funds set aside, because, you know, this is, John, this isn't the 60s where you went and started. You worked for a company 30 years, you retired with a defined benefit pension plan. They're saying today, with the pace of technology, rapid development and technological progress, that the average individual getting out of college will probably have three or four major career moves or company moves in their working career. So in between those moves, you need to set aside some money for emergency funds. And all of this means you have to prioritize in sequence. For example, let's take a couple that are, let's say, mid-20s. Let's say they're both age 25, just to simplify. Their first goal is they want to buy a house. So they want to put aside money for a down payment on a home. Let's say, let's throw kids into the equation. Let's say they also happen to have, they're starting a family. So they have a couple of kids. Now, at age 25, they're looking 40 years out into the future in terms of retirement. So if you prioritize, goal number one is putting money aside for a down payment on a house. Goal number two might be putting aside a small amount of money for a college education. And goal number three might be a retirement. So if we take this in, let's say, five-year increments, let's say maybe the first 5 years, 70% of one saving dollar goes towards a savings account that's going to be used on a down payment on a house. Maybe 20% of that savings is going towards a college education for the children, and maybe only 10% is going to go towards retirement. So the furthest goal at age 25 is retirement, which is 40 years away. Now let's take 5 years from now. Let's assume that you amass the money or enough money to put a down payment on a house. So now out of each dollar of savings, maybe you start targeting about 80% of your savings, let's say towards your children's education, and then maybe 20% towards retirement. Maybe you start increasing the amount you put away in your 401k plan. And then finally, in the next 5 years, we've now gone out 15 years now. You're age 40. In the final years, you're now, let's say, 20 years, 25 years away from retirement. That's when you start devoting almost 100% of your savings toward your retirement objective. So the key in this, John, is to, number one, prioritize your goals and sequence them. And you're not going to be able to put 100% of your savings when you're trying to save for a house, put away money for your children's education, money for a car, emergency, and retirement. And so you sequence them. The most important ones are the near-term goals, having the money for a down payment on a house, the intermediate goals, have money put aside for weddings, or let's say your children's education, and then eventually retirement. So you sequence them and you prioritize. I think that's the real key here.
So numero uno, you have to have a plan. That would be the first thing, is to establish a plan. Number two would be to save. You're going to have to do this. And to do that, there's a certain level of discipline to follow the plan. You have to delay some gratification in this area to stick to the plan. Now, that's quite oftentimes hard to do if you look at the way the world runs nowadays with buy, 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 upgrade, 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 have the latest, 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 and don't forget Starbucks.
You know, John, there's no magic to this. I mean, it basically starts with discipline and savings. And if you don't have any discipline, or if you've never tried to save or put money aside, then you're going to have to re-educate yourself. And it's one of the statistics I read that a lot of the divorces today have to deal with a lot of financial issues where, you know, people live beyond their means, they get into financial debt, one spouse loses their job, or the debts start piling up and they can't afford to live the life that they wanted to live without having access to credit. And this is something I think as parents we can go a long way to instill in our children. I mean, it's something my parents instilled in me, and it's something that, John, that we did with our three sons early on. I mean, basically, we gave our kids, we have three sons, we gave them a free pass until they graduated from eighth grade. When they started high school, we said, guys, you have to go out and get a job. And, of course, when you're in high school, the first thing, just like a young family starting out, you want to have, let's say, enough money to buy your first home or have enough money for a down payment on a home. A lot of people in high school, a lot of high school kids, boy, I want my own car. And hopefully my son Ryan is not listening to this conversation, John, but I remember my son Ryan, he had gotten his permit. He was 15 and a half. and he was getting close to his 16th birthday. And he came home one day and he goes, you know, Mom and Dad, I'd kind of like to have a talk with you after dinner. And I thought, oh my, what's going on here? Is there something that I'm going to get hit with that I'm not going to want to hear? And so I can remember Mary and I, we went into my study, and Ryan came in and and he sat down. And he goes, well, as you know, my birthday's coming up. This was about 2 weeks from his birthday. We need to talk about what kind of car I'm getting. I just kind of looked at him. I go, what kind of car are you getting? He goes, yeah. He said, you know, I'm 16. I'm going to need a car to drive. And I said, well, let me ask you this. How much money do you have in the bank? And he, well, I don't have any money in the bank. I said, well, then how are you going to buy a car? And he goes, well, you know, all my friends' parents are buying them cars. And I go, well, that's your friends' parents. That's us. And so it was this big reality check that he had. And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. You come up with the down payment on the car, and I will go with you. I will co-sign on that car. And what we will do is, parents, we will pay for your insurance and your gas money. But until you have enough money for a down payment on the car, you're going to have to drive Mom and Dad's car. You're not going to have your own car. And that was a reality check. So, John, if you take a look at this, anybody starting out today, and anybody that has children that you want to instill these kind of characteristics that are going to help them throughout their adult life, it all boils down to the two things we started this conversation: start early and save. And when it comes to planning for retirement, you better know what that number is going to be. In other words, what are you going to need to support your living when you retire at age 65, 66, whatever that number is? You need to know your number. Number two, you need to know the savings rate that is going to help you hit that number. And number three, you better invest appropriately. When you've got 40 years ahead of you, you need to be investing for growth, no matter what the market's doing, because you can dollar cost average. If you're in a 401k program, they're taking the money out of your paycheck. There's a key thing you need to understand. When the market goes down, the money they take out of your paycheck is going to buy more shares when the market's down than when the market's going up. And all you care about when you get to retirement is how many shares you own, not where the market is.
All right, Jim, as you're moving along the trail and you're going from college into life and then you're moving through the years, how do you tell how well you're doing? I mean, really, in terms of where you need to end up, because you make a plan at point A, you're going to point Z, but in between, maybe point Z moved a bit due to conditions in the, what, the economy or something like that. So how do you tell where you are?
You know, it's interesting because there was a study done by the investment firm Fidelity regarding retirement. And you should have 8 times your salary to retire. And they put this along benchmarks. And John, what they said is you should aim to have 8 times your ending salary in order to replace 85% of your pre-retirement income and meet your basic income needs throughout retirement, because people are living longer today. And they said most people starting out planning for retirement today, the retirement age is going to be moving up, just as it's done for boomers to age 66 and 67. So basically, here's a scorecard if you want to know how well you're doing. By age 35, you should have 1 times your annual salary at age 35. At age 45, you should have 3 times your annual salary saved up. And by age 55, you should have 5 times as much of your salary at age 55. And the two greatest impacts on your retirement savings are, number one, as we've been talking about, John, starting early and saving consistently. I can't emphasize that over and over again. And so if you want to use a benchmark, you should have 8 times your ending salary by the time you retire at age 67. Now, if you're starting at age 25, you need to put a smaller amount away to achieve your objective, because you're going to be putting away money for 42 years. In 42 years of compounding, adds up.
So let's see if we can summarize this up for everyone as we try to do it. Come back to what we used to call, when you're writing them out, bullet items. Number one, graduate. That may sound silly, but it's really true. Number one, do it from high school. Number two, do it from college. If your high school is a lousy high school, go find a better high school. Number two, as far as planning for retirement, begin early. Number three, remember to invest and to save. You got to have a plan, and part of that is investing and saving. You have to have the discipline to follow that plan and avoid the temptation for instant gratification. And above all, diversify and don't be afraid to revise the plan if circumstances dictate. So I would think that's a pretty good summary. Oh, hold on a second, Jim. Hey, Ryan, you want to hear what your dad said about you?
Thanks, John. Can you give me Troy's number?
Yeah, I'll do that. Wait a minute. Let's do that during the break. You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. One of the great developments that cable broadcasting has bought us are the cable news channels. And you must admit, Jim, it is an incredible accomplishment of technology and of intelligence where they have managed to take a 5-minute story and turn it into a 24-hour newscast. Okay, that's the first thing. Because you hear it over and over and over and over and over. You know, there's an old expression in our business, if it bleeds, it leads. Meaning the story that has the most gore to it or has the most sensationalism to it gets the most attention. And a lot of times you have disaster, whether it's terror, earthquakes, market crashes, whatever it happens to be, it's going to lead that story cycle that goes up every half hour on the cable news channels along with the other newscasts. The problem with that is it tends to produce, especially if it happens to be in the market, a lot of angst. And you heard talking in the debate. It came up this week in the vice presidential debate. Well, what if I'd had my money in the market? I would have lost everything. But now because of the fact that government's going to take over, your healthcare is going to be there or something along those lines. Of course, they're not fessing up to the fact that government's broke and it's not going to be there to do it. But that's okay. We'll put that aside. But nevertheless, investors are acting irrationally. People are sucking money out of the market since, well, look at it. It's up over 114% since, 2009?
Yeah.
So the real question is, if the herd is running in one direction, how can you make your own investing decisions? How do you avoid getting caught in this? Jim, as human critters, we just want to run with the herd. It just feels so good. And then you as an advisor, I don't know how I do what you do, because I'm sure in the terms of the history of your managing investments for people, you have somebody who's looking over your shoulder trying to drive from the back seat or Monday morning quarterbacking on everything you're doing. That would drive me cuckoo. So how do you make sound decisions in the light of wherever the herd is going? The herd's almost always running in the wrong direction.
Well, I mean, you just mentioned one of the problems that investors face today, and then also as advisors, and that's this steady stream, John, of bad news peddled by smart, very sophisticated communicators who are, by the way, as you well know, are very savvy in the way they get people addicted to the bad news cocktail. I mean, John, you remember it was the late 80s, I think it was 89 maybe, the World Series in San Francisco where they had the earthquake where the Bay Bridge collapsed.
Yeah, there was the Loma Prieta quake and the Bay Bridge, one section of the cantilever collapsed and the top deck of the Nimitz Freeway in Oakland collapsed. And it was right during the World Series. I think it was 94. I can't remember.
Oh, okay. But I can remember because I read this in a book that was very impactive because I just come out of television news and I was sort of getting exposed in terms of how we create the news, how we present it, what we spike. And the book was called Anchors. And they had like three chapters of that earthquake event. And they talked about how they had different camera shots of the pancaked Bay Bridge, the different fires, and they kept showing them over and over again for 3 days. And I remember my mother-in-law calling us just extremely frightened. You know, we're down in San Diego. This is up in San Francisco. I mean, she was acting like California was falling off the ocean. And, you know, it was basically, you guys want to come to Phoenix? Maybe you want to get out of there. And same thing even here with the fires that broke out here in San Diego in 2007. But this is the problem. There's a whole business that has been created, and I call it the gloom and doom business. And one of the things that you have to do is you have to divorce yourself and immunize yourself against the news media and the peddlers of doom. Doom is a big business today. And as advisors, John, you have to sit there and you have to talk people off the ledge, because every time there's an incident, I mean, look at the wall of worry that we've been climbing all year long. I don't care if it's Europe, it's China's slowdown, it's the Arab Spring, the Middle East, the hurricane season, the recent terrorist attacks. I mean, there's always something that the markets are worried about. And the thing is, as advisors, John, if you take a look at some of the people we interview on this program, and we interview some very, very sharp and very smart people. But the truth is, you don't know what's going to happen, and you can't believe anybody knows what's going to happen either. In other words, you can't have somebody come on and say, well, you know, this is going to happen on this date, and this date. I mean, we have technicians on the program and saying, you know, looking at the charts right now, this is what the charts tell me. But, you know, that's why we try to get different technicians here on the show every week, because they all bring a different perspective. But the most important thing is, the better game from an investment point of view is to focus on things that you can control and be prepared for the future. And there is a famous line from Peter Drucker, and he said, the best way to predict your future is to create it. And the best way to create that is have a plan. This is following up the segment that we've been doing here over the last 3 or 4 months about retirement planning. Whether you're getting ready to retire, you just retired, you were forced into retirement, or you're a young person, as we talked about today, planning for the future. The plan is not going to stop any of the unpredictable events that you're going to see on television. But it does alter how you feel about them between now and when they do or could happen. For example, John, we have always had backup plans here for the business. And these backup plans have come into play several times. And one of the ones that really sticks out in my mind was the one, John, and you remember this, in 2007, where we evacuated probably over 500,000 people out of the city of San Diego, as we had 3 major fires here. And we had backup emergencies, all our vital papers. We had backup plans for the business. And fortunately, we were able to execute and go to plan C. We had plan B, which was no longer workable because the fires were spreading. And so we went to a contingent plan that we had, plan C. And we were able to ride out the fires, operate our business, and we were able to do that from the day the fires broke out. Likewise, last September, John, you remember, the lights of San Diego went out. We basically lost power to the entire city as a result of an accident at a power station on the Arizona-California border. And I remember going home, and then all of a sudden, the lights went out, and I thought, oh boy, something blew a fuse or something, because we were running air conditioning, and then all of a sudden it persisted. And then I got a call from my son. He goes, Dad, they're talking about a terrorist attack. They took out a power plant. Well, we went into backup mode. We went into plan B. First thing we did is we have a portable backup radio, self-winding, turned on the radio, and the first thing I found out was, no, it was a power station that went out. We had food. We were able to barbecue our dinner outside. We had water. In other words, we had contingency plans that we put in place when this hit. And so instead of panicking, as some people do, we had a plan that said, when an emergency hits, this is what we're going to resort to. So this is the important thing about investing, because when you prepare for the future, who knows where the stock market's going to be a year from now? Who knows where it's going to be 2 years or 5 years from now? The important thing is, if you take a look at the things that you control, and this is almost a universal law that a lot of the investment coaches and motivational coaches always focus on. And this lies in the universal law that successful people tend to focus on what they can control. And that is the most important thing. So when you're looking at the future, you got to be prepared for that future. But the confidence is going to come from having a plan so that when something happens, you know what to do and you don't find yourself reacting, jumping out of windows, or taking drastic actions as many people do today.
Maybe a lot of this ties together with what we were discussing earlier, and that is the whole issue of numbers and where you get your information, because people are a little nervous that you look back. We've had, what, two bear markets in stocks? There's been the sudden shock in drop in real estate prices. And depending on where people got their information, some people saw these things coming ahead of time and took the right action. Others kept going with the herd information. Maybe we should come up with HNN, the Herd News Network, or something like that. And that's shaking people's confidence, and that's why they're jittery about this whole thing.
I think you hit on some key issues, because if you look at the last decade, John, we had two bear markets, but believe it or not, prior to the 80s and 90s, that was pretty standard in every decade. In other words, the business cycle lasted between 3 and 5 years. When you went into the downturn of the business cycle, you usually had a bear market. And so we're going back more towards a standard business cycle. The unfortunate thing is in the 80s and 90s, we saw a big accumulation in debt. We saw interest rates coming down. We were seeing almost double-digit gains in the stock market year after year. And as a result, the savings rate in this country declined from about 8% down to zero. And also, during this period of time, investment returns went up in the double-digit category. So what we saw is people added more debt, they over-leveraged to increase consumption. So instead of using lower interest rates, and this probably occurred more so in the last decade, as Greenspan and Bernanke really slashed interest rates, a lot of individuals used those lower interest rates to refinance their home. But what they were doing, John, is instead of just lowering payments, which would allow them to increase savings, instead, they took large amounts of equity out of their home, and the home really became an ATM machine. And so what they did is they used the lower interest rates to add more debt to fuel consumption, the very issues that we're talking about the U.S. government is doing today. In addition to that, I think we expanded the concept of what it meant to be middle class. And so now reality is setting in. And what I believe is now impacting people is they're now discovering in their own personal finances that their own financial house is not in order and retirement is directly ahead of them. And I think it's scaring a lot of people. And as a result of that, they're exposed for the first time as, wow, I really thought I had it made. Our home would go up each year and we'll just cash out of that. The stock market will go up 10 to 15% each year. So, you know what? It was sort of on autopilot. Now, people are faced with a stark reality as we return to normal business cycles and market cycles.
Well, but you know, I think the positive is that a lot of people are waking up to this stark reality. And if they do, and they're weighing their, well, let's go back to what we were talking about earlier, their retirement plans against what they're seeing here, there's still opportunity here.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the options we talked about here, and you've heard me discuss over the last probably 4 or 5 months, is you can reduce your retirement income needs. And there's a couple ways that you can do this. For example, you can postpone for a year or 2 years later when you retire. You can reduce the cost of your retirement lifestyle if it means relocating, downsizing, as Carl and Tish did last week in the case study that we discussed, or you can reduce and eliminate bequests to children. I mean, if it gets down to it, whether you're going to leave something to your children or survive so you'll be able to take care of yourself, those are decisions you're going to have to make. Other things that you can do part-time work during retirement. I have a doctor who doesn't need to work, but he enjoys doing it. And so what he's doing is he's working part-time, and because what he earns in that part-time employment is enough to pay for most of his living needs and a lot of his vacation. He's hardly tapping anything that he has in his investment portfolio, and that portfolio continues to grow. You can spend less or save more prior to retirement. In other words, maybe you downsize prior to retirement in order to be able to increase your savings. And you need to invest, if you're looking at 5-10 years away from retirement, putting all your money in cash and putting all your money in the bond fund is not the way you're going to achieve your retirement goals. So you've got to come up with a plan, just as we talk about looking at your retirement in 5-year increments, taking a look at your portfolio as different buckets to accomplish different objectives. It's the same thing with retirement. So, John, there's still plenty of options left. I don't care if it's retiring later, reducing lifestyle, downsizing, part-time work. So all is not lost here.
Well, I guess the classic example are some of the people I talk to at the gym. You know, investors are piling into bond funds, coming back to my old adage, the herd's running in the wrong direction. They're reacting in fear. That creates a stampede. They really want to do something with their money, but they're afraid. They go, well, look what happened just like there. You have to get over that at some point or another. How do you steer them into feeling that they're actually doing something worthwhile?
First of all, you got to back away from the situation and say, do you have a plan? What is your plan? And if you don't have a plan, well, then you have a problem. And you have to start with putting a plan together. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself reacting to every news cycle. If the market's going up, you're going to think, oh my goodness, I need to get back into stocks. If the market's going down, oh, I need to get out of stocks. And we put together a study, and we took the SPYDRS, SPY, and we took a look at the closing price on December 31st, 2007. The SPYDRS were selling it at $146.21 a share. And we took a look at, had you put $100,000 in the SPYDRS, you would own 684 shares. If you take a look at the dividend income from those SPYDRS, it was $1,900 in 2008. By 2012, it was about $1,950. So the SPYDRS aren't really a good example because they're always rotating the stocks that make up the S&P. But here's the important thing. Even if you look at the rate of return of the SPYDRS, and as of this week on October 10th, which was the day we completed the study, price appreciation was a negative 7%. The income return was 11%. And so your income returns were 100% came from dividends. Now, one of the things that we like to talk about is there are other ways that you can take a look at this. And that is, if you're dollar cost averaging, and especially if you're a young person, because we've been talking about young people starting out, remember every week or every 2 weeks, however often you get your paycheck, you're taking money and you're putting money into your 401k program. Now, what you're doing when you're buying shares is you're dollar cost averaging. So let's say you're putting $100 a paycheck. If you're putting $100 a paycheck and the stock market goes down, the $100 this week will buy you more shares with the market down than it did the previous week when the market's up. And the most important thing that you're going to care about is how many shares you're going to own 40 years from now when you retire.
You know, it's interesting that in the past you would talk about dollar cost averaging. People don't seem to be discussing that now as being somewhat advantageous. But what are you doing? If we look back at the 2008 debacle when in the investment markets people really got clobbered, people are afraid of that happening again. So what scenario would you do to prep for something like that or anticipate it?
I give some practical examples. I'll just tell you what I'm doing in my own personal situation. I own oil stocks. I own consumer staple stocks. I own big box retailers. And John, like my parents and like my grandfather, I'm dividend and reinvesting. I don't need the dividends at this point in my life. And so when the dividends come in, I have them reinvested in the shares that I own. So I own a lot more shares today than what I did 5 years ago. And I'm not going to tell you what I own, but I'm going to give you some real live examples. And I always like to stay with the Dow stocks because they're a good example. And let's just take the company called Chevron. And if we take a look at Chevron, this is a Dow 30 stock, big oil company. Chevron has a dividend yield of 3%. Chevron has increased its dividends 9.2% a year for the last 5 years, 9.15% last 3 years, and 14% in the last 12 months. Now, if you take a look at Chevron, and let's take a worst case basis. Let's go back to 12/31/2007. If I look at Chevron, since January 1st of 2008, Chevron shares are up 24.9%. If I take a look at total return, which is price appreciation plus dividends, Chevron shares are up 46.5%. That compounds to an 8.4% annually. So even though we had a crisis, even though Chevron shares fell during that crisis and went down, they recovered. They're higher today than where they were back then. And during that period of time, Chevron increased their dividends through that entire period. Let's take another example. Let's take Coca-Cola. Everybody knows people buy Coke all around the globe. Coke has increased its dividend 8.5% a year over the last 5 years, 7.5% the last three, and 8.1% over the last 12 months. The dividend yield on Chevron is 2.6%. Now let's take a look at, let's just say you owned Coca-Cola during the crisis. You held on to the crisis, and better yet, you reinvested your dividends. Since the crisis, Coca-Cola shares are up about 23.6%, and the total return on Coca-Cola is 42.25%, an annual compound rate of 7.7%. Folks, that's a whole lot better than 1.68% on a 10-year treasury note. Let's take another Dow stock, Walmart. You take a look at Walmart today. Here has been a super dividend grower. They've grown their dividends at 13.5% over the last 5 years, 13.9% over the last 3 years, and 11.5% over the last 1 year. Walmart's dividend is about 2%. But let's assume that you owned Walmart at the beginning of the financial crisis. You held on to your shares, reinvested the dividends. Walmart stock is up almost 55.3% over that period of time. The total return is 72.5%. The annual return compounded is 12.2%. And let me just give you one more example of a company, and this is IBM, one of the big Dow stocks. IBM has increased its dividend at 18% a year over the last five, 15% over the last three, and over 14% over the last year. IBM's dividend right now is 1.5%, so just slightly less than what you would have gotten, let's say, on a 10-year treasury note. Let me just go over here for a second and get the closing quote here on 10-year treasuries to illustrate this point. 10-year treasuries are 1.65, so IBM's dividend yield at 1.58 is just slightly less. But, you know, let's just assume that you bought IBM, you held it at the beginning of 2008. IBM's price appreciation since January 1st of 2008 is 92%. The total return is 109% with an annual compound rate of 16.8%. So, John, these are just practical examples. And I'm just picking some companies out of the Dow. Now, I want to put a caveat there. I mean, you really need to know what you're picking. And there's no way that I could guarantee that, IBM will continue to increase its dividends at 19% a year. I can't. And I can't tell you that IBM's price appreciation will be 92% over probably the next 5 years. But I will probably tell you that I can say with a fair degree of confidence is that Chevron is probably still going to sell gasoline and be producing oil 5 years from now. We're still going to be using and running our economy on oil. Walmart is probably still going to be in the retail business. In fact, they're going to build over 300 stores in China. Coca-Cola is probably still going to be selling Coke, and IBM is going to be making mainframe computers and selling software services. So, you know, this is just an example. Had you panicked and gone into the bond market at probably some of the lowest returns that we've seen in half a century, rather than just hold on to good quality companies and just dividend reinvest, look at a world of difference between those returns.
What is always instructive is a real life case. I remember when we were back during the downturn and, you know, you took a hit during the downturn, but at the same time, you were talking people out of jumping out a window, say, for example, over the whole situation or making those classic mistakes, selling at the bottom, etc. So how did you deal with those things?
We had a case here, a doctor that we did here on the program. And this was a client of mine who's been with me since 1985. And at that time, John, his portfolio, when the market peaked, was worth about $2 million. And his portfolio took about a 28% hit during the downturn. Now, that was a lot better than the 42% hit that the S&P took, but that was because we owned a lot of dividend-paying blue-chip stocks. So that $2 million portfolio got down to less than $1.5 million. Now, nobody likes to see something like that when you're at one level, and especially when you're getting close to retirement. However, today, that portfolio is worth $3 million, not less than $1.5 million. And more importantly, and this is the real important point to grasp here, that portfolio had an average yield back then roughly about 2.5%. That was yielding about $50,000 a year. Today, that portfolio is producing over $75,000 a year in terms of dividends and income, and it's going up each year. And that's the thing. Let's say that, you know, I can't sit here on the air and say that 5 years from now, we're not going to have another bear market, because I can't. Nobody can promise you, and any of the people on this program will never promise you that same thing. But let's say, John, in this case, this client's portfolio is now worth $3 million. Let's say that in the next 12 months, we take another crash like we did in 2008. We have another major crisis, and this portfolio goes down 28% as it did in 2008 in early 2009. First of all, the $75,000 of dividends that are being produced right now is not going to change. The companies that are paying those dividends are high-quality companies, high free cash flow, strong balance sheets, international franchises. That income will not change. In fact, in the next 12 months, I would say with a high degree of predictability, it is likely the income in this portfolio is going to increase. And I say that with a high degree of probability because I know the dividend track record of the companies in this portfolio. So the income is not going to change. And that's the thing that you have to keep in mind. Am I saying go put all your money in stocks? No. But what I am saying is anytime you see these bad news cycles, don't get yourself in a bunker mentality. Sell everything you own because you're going to end up regretting it later on.
You know, I thought the vice presidential debate this week, Jim, was a sort of a lackluster debate. They went back and forth, and there's all sorts of comments, blah, blah, blah. But an election usually isn't made or broken on the basis of the vice presidential debates. What I really want to see is the next two debates between President Obama and Governor Romney, and to see how President Obama comes back, because I think that's going to determine a lot of the direction. But again, as I've said before, and this is why it's important to have alternative media, the chasm between political rhetoric, not just in the debates or the candidates now, but also in between Congress and reality, is growing. And when that tension finally ruptures, you get some kind of a political and economic earthquake. And that's where I think we're headed right now. But that's why it's important to do shows like this one.
This is the beginning of the third quarter earnings season, John. So the markets, the two big issues right now are the fiscal cliff and corporate earnings. Now, we've had enough pre-warnings from companies. In fact, they've set the earnings bar so low, it's actually gone below underground, John. So I suspect we're going to see a lot of companies beating estimates because they've been lowered so much. So over the next couple of weeks, those are the big things to watch. We're going to also be watching the LEIs, which have been starting to tick up, and the regionals have started to improve. So did we just hit a soft patch? Or is this temporary? And will the Fed's QE be enough to boost the markets in the economy? A lot of stuff to talk about in the weeks ahead. No shortage of events that we'll be discussing on the program. But in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.